Hello, and welcome to Planet SciComm, a Utah Science Communicators podcast. On Planet SciComm, we seek to bring you casual yet informative conversations with scientists in the Utah community. We hope that through these discussions, we can teach the general public about cool science while humanizing the people who are doing that science. I'm Sarah. I am the Vice President of Utah Science Communicators.
And I am Allie. I am the President of Utah Science Communicators.
And we're hosting today's Planet SciComm episode. We're so excited to be here. And we are extra excited to be interviewing Courtney Demet Rice on the podcast. Courtney, I would love to start with having you tell us a little bit about who you are.
All right. So, yeah, I'm a fourth-year PhD candidate in the Bonkofsky Lab here at the University of Utah. We study white matter disorders. I am also a mom to three kids, one of whom has an ultra-rare disease, is medically complex, and disabled.
So I want to start with how you found yourself in the world of science. We like to really talk about at USCO people's unconventional journeys to science, and I'm wondering what your journey was like.
I don't know about you guys. I enjoyed science as a child. I had like science textbooks I would read. My mom actually went to undergrad when I was a child. So I remember even taking her earth science textbook and like flipping through it and reading it when I was like 6 years old. Like I would read, you know, like the medical encyclopedia. Like I just thought that was really interesting. I don't know. Were you guys into science when you were kids?
I was into what I now think of as science, but at the time as a kid, like I did not like sitting down. Honestly, I guess like you, I was not into reading the textbooks, but I loved like going outside into nature and just like running around all day, finding little things and exploring stuff like that. So I guess in the less conventional sense, maybe in a different sense than you were into science.
You're like a field scientist.
Oh, yeah. I was really out there with the elements. What about you, Sarah?
So as a child, I didn't despise science, but as a high schooler, I completely associated science with something that was so boring because I wasn't taught the scientific process at all. I didn't get to understand how cool and fun science was until I got to college, but I got there eventually, and that's really all that matters.
So I was really interested in science as a kid, and then in high school, I think I actually got like C's in biology, if I'm being completely honest. I was like, I have no motivation to memorize the Krebs cycle. Like, this is not interesting to me. So I think that even though I liked science when I got into high school, just, yeah, again, the way it was taught, I think kind of I was like, it's okay. When I started college, I actually was interested in being a nurse, and I took like a microbiology for health professions class. And the teacher was talking about like using microbes for bioremediation, and I was like, this is so cool. And I think like learning that, how we could actually like use science and like microbes to solve like environmental problems and all of these other problems, I was like, this is actually really interesting. So at that point, I actually switched from being pre-nursing to then joining a biotechnology program. And when I was doing that, I actually came up here to the U and I had a summer undergraduate research experience doing T-cell memory research to kind of figure out how we could make vaccines more effective. And so at that point, I also took a parasitology class like around that same time, had a really cool teacher. I think I just left that parasitology class one day thinking like, this is what I meant to do. Like, this is going to be my thing. And I have a lot of thoughts in my head, very active brain. And so I just remember, like I said, leaving that one day and just having this kind of sense of like calm and peace and just this very like focused, like this is it for me. So at that time, I think I really knew I was dedicated to science. And when I graduated, I was really interested in making vaccines for parasitic diseases, like tropical neglected diseases. That's kind of like where I was when I graduated.
I personally love the medical profession to scientific research pipeline. I feel like it's like the dark side of the biomedical track, where it's like, oh, I actually don't want to do these medical things. I just want to mess around in a scientific lab all day.
I'm so curious. since you talked about really loving science as a kid and then getting into high school, not loving it as much. I think that's honestly a common experience because who likes to memorize a bunch of random facts? No one. And then kind of found your way back to it in undergrad, but went first the nursing track. Were you attracted to that specifically through like a love or interest in science, or was it more the side of, I think medical professions sometimes attract people because they want to care for people and they really like this idea of helping others? So were you kind of in it for that and then inadvertently kind of got into the science and realized your love for it, or were you always kind of in it for the science from the start?
I think it was both. I think there was that like intellectual or academic interest in the science of medicine. Right. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, I was like, I do enjoy interacting with people. I like feeling like I'm helping people. I like feeling like I'm serving people and that I have that kind of purpose. So I think it was really a combination of those two things.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that kind of segues nicely into the research that you're doing right now, because I think even though you aren't on the front lines providing care, your research is very focused on helping people. So would love to hear a little bit, if you could tell our good listeners about what your research is and what you do.
Sure. So like I said, our lab focuses on neurological diseases, specifically kind of more pediatric neurological diseases. So, of course, in your brain, you have nerves, right? And all of the nerves are just like electrical wiring where they need insulation. And that insulation in the brain is called myelin or myelination. And so there's a group of diseases called white matter disorders that specifically affect that insulation of the brain's nerves. So that's kind of what our lab focuses on. And then my project specifically, I study a disease called adrenoleukodystrophy. And that is one of these white matter disorders. And it's been researched, I think it was first described maybe in like the 60s, 50s or 60s, I think maybe. And kind of in that 60-year period of studying this disease, nobody's really cracked the code on understanding actually here's the gene mutation, but like, why is that causing a disease? Like, it's still kind of a black box. We don't understand that yet. And so, of course, it's also been really hard to find treatments and cures. So people with adrenoleukodystrophy just don't have good treatment or cure options. And so my project is kind of focusing specifically on how these cells that are affected by this disease, how we think that they have a hard time digesting cholesterol, and that this kind of like failure to bring cholesterol in and digest it in the cell, that actually might be what's causing the disease.
And for those who are not familiar with the importance of cholesterol, why do we care about cholesterol? There's like good cholesterol, bad cholesterol, but can you explain why that is biologically relevant for your research?
Yes, great question. Yeah, no, I feel kind of bad for cholesterol because everybody's like, ew, cholesterol. Like,
but there's also good cholesterol, but yes. I bet even just like the good and bad is a kind of simplistic way to think about it, I bet.
Yeah, so all of like every single cell in your body needs cholesterol. So if you remember back to high school biology, right, you have your cell and it's surrounded by a membrane, which is basically a little fat bag. And there's a lot of cholesterol in that fat bag. And so if your cells don't have cholesterol, the cells can't build themselves. They can't build all their little organs and they can't build their membrane. And so, yeah, it's really important for all of your cells to be able to either make cholesterol or to bring it in from the foods that you eat and then put it, you know, wherever in the cell it needs to go at that time. And in the brain, that's especially important because in your nervous system, because of the blood-brain barrier, whatever cholesterol came out of the Big Mac you just ate is not going to cross the blood-brain barrier and get into your brain. So your brain has its own system of making and like sharing and distributing cholesterol. So when you have a problem with your brain's cholesterol system, it can't be rescued just by like, oh, change your diet. And so we really have to figure out like, why is cholesterol maybe more important, you know, in neurological cells, and how can we help them with that problem? So
just to connect this back to your actual project, honestly, out of my own curiosity. So is the idea, so cholesterol is really important for building these structures that the cell needs potentially to survive. So is the idea that the lack of cholesterol then leads to the cell not being able to properly build those myelin sheaths, which are insulating these connections between different cells? Is that where the importance of cholesterol comes in?
So there, cholesterol is actually important to a lot of different cell processes. So the one that you just mentioned, of course, right, is that myelin is a high fat substance, mm-hmm. right? And so, yes, there is a lot of cholesterol in myelin. So, yeah, if cells can't take that in and, like, yeah, build out with it properly, that's going to be a problem. Cholesterol actually has a lot to do with inflammation as well. Mm-hmm. And microglia and macrophages, so those are different kinds of immune cells, they will alter their immune activities depending on, like, what kind of cholesterol they have and that sort of thing. And then neurons are kind of babies, right? Like, neurons, their job is just to fire, and they kind of need the other cells around them to, like, take care of them.
And, I actually love that analogy.
And cholesterol metabolism is one of those things. It's that having astrocytes and microglia that are also in the brain that can take some of that cholesterol up from the environment and then digest it because the neuron just can't be bothered. So,
I love that.
So yeah, the cholesterol economy is definitely different in the brain compared to the rest of the body. But yes, myelin and building myelin and having that white matter, cholesterol is really important for that.
Is cholesterol also, I'm thinking back to my biology classes, but cholesterol is also related to lipid rafts, right? Yeah. I always loved that term because I loved the idea of, like, little rafts in our cells that are, I don't know, providing life-saving things for us.
So, yeah, within your cell's membrane, like, there's a lot of different parts to that membrane, right? Like, there's proteins in there and there's a lot of different fats because remember, it's a fat bag. But there's a lot of different kinds of fats. And so actually within that cell membrane, you will have different kinds of lipids or fats organizing themselves within that membrane. And so, yeah, lipid rafts can be areas where there's like a concentration of very specific lipids of one type in one part of the membrane. And that usually facilitates different types of functions. And so, yeah, so lipid rafts are cool. And just the lipidome in general is really interesting. I think, like, you know, the genome, everybody's heard of the genome, right? Even people who aren't in science, they know what the genome is. And then, you know, we got really into the proteome, which is like understanding all the proteins in the cells.
The world of omes.
Yeah. So then one of the things that really hasn't been very well explored is the lipidome. So that's understanding all of the different fats that are part of biology. And so because with proteins, it's like you have a gene and a gene makes a protein. And it's pretty straightforward, right? Like, there's some other stuff that goes on, but it's pretty straightforward. But as far as lipids are concerned, there are enzymes and proteins that we make that make lipids or modify lipids, but the lipidome is actually not fully encoded by the genome. Hmm. So we're still figuring out, like, how the relationship between these two things. And that's actually very – that comes back to my project. So people with adrenal leukodystrophy have mutations in a gene called ABCD1, and we know that ABCD1 – works with a very specific type of lipid. But when you look at people with adrenal leukodystrophy, they actually have changes to thousands of different lipids in their body, even though ABCD1 only works with a specific, like, subset of lipids. So really understanding how this one gene mutation can then lead to these really broad, widespread changes in the lipidome gets at this kind of black box question of, like, how do we get the lipids and the fats that we have from the genes that we have?
Just so I'm understanding this correctly, do we know where lipids that are not directly encoded in the genome or created by some protein that comes from transcription translation of our DNA, like, do we know where they come from? Or that's still an open question of, like, this lipid exists in the brain, but we aren't sure.
I don't know, actually, if we were to say, like, there's 3,000 species of lipids. I don't know if we're, like, we know the origin and, you know, how 75% of them are made. I am actually
so
not sure. And then the other component, right, with lipids is diet.
Right. That's
so
what I was thinking.
You get from your diet. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and then I would love to talk about this, but also then there's like the microbiome, right? Like how do the microbes in your gut digest and change and use up lipids before they ever get distributed to your body? And like, yeah, so there's many layers.
Wow. Yeah, I can't say I have ever thought about the lipids in our brains, to be honest. And I'm a neuroscientist, so there you go.
No one thinks
Everyone
about lipids.
Be thinking about those lipids. They are important too. So you mentioned earlier in your brief introduction that you are also a parent. And I think in at least our department, the other grad students that I'm interacting with on a day-to-day basis typically don't have children. So I think that's pretty unique, at least for the scientists and grad students in our department. So I'm curious kind of how that process is for you of managing family and managing grad school, and tell us a little bit about how that impacts your life as a scientist.
Yeah, so I think the biggest influence is probably, like I mentioned earlier, when I graduated, I was really interested in studying neglected tropical parasitic diseases. So I already kind of had an interest in, I guess, like rare or like untreated diseases. So then actually 2-3 weeks after I graduated with my bachelor's, I had my youngest. So her name is June. And when she was born, within like a week and a half or 2 weeks, we found out that she had an ultra rare intestinal disorder and needed surgery. And she was in the NICU for a while. But then over the next like year, since she was my third child, like I could tell that like she wasn't developmentally doing the things that you expect kids to do, even though she had been in and out of the hospital a lot and had been sick a lot. We actually ended up with the Undiagnosed Diseases Network, which is like, how do I describe this? It's like an NIH, I guess, kind of like there's clinical sites that are associated with the NIH throughout the United States. But they take people that have like diseases that have not been diagnosed as anything, that don't fit any kind of known diagnosis, and they are able to kind of like fast track genetic testing for these groups of people. And so we ended up with the Undiagnosed Diseases Clinic, and we had some genetic testing done, and we found out that she had a mutation in a gene called NOTCH1 that's actually like very, very important for many, 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 many developmental pathways. And over time, that made sense because most of her organ systems are affected by her mutation. And so there weren't a lot of other people, like, the disease didn't have a name, right? It was just like, here's this mutation. It makes a lot of sense that this mutation is probably what's causing the disease, but we can't for sure say that. We don't have the research to back up that claim, but it's very suspicious that we think that this mutation is involved in your child's disease. And so, we didn't know anybody else that had this disease. It doesn't have a name, so you can't, like, Google, like, looking for support groups or doctors that specialize in this disease. And so that was a really it was really surprising. And neither my husband or I have, like, a family history of anything like this. And so it was just very, you know, unexpected. But so at that time, getting kind of, like, thrown into that situation, one of the ways you could describe her disease is calling it a leukodystrophy. So again, that's a white matter disorder. And so I started learning about white matter disorders and how, like, pretty much all of them are rare. The burden of disease lays mostly with children. These diseases are often fatal. There's not treatments for these diseases. And so that's how I kind of got, like, thrown into being interested in white matter disorders. And so after I graduated, I knew I wanted to go to graduate school, but then I had her, and then she needed a lot of surgeries, a lot of time in the hospital, a lot of therapies. And I just felt like I couldn't commit to being in graduate school, and that obviously her health needed to come first. And we didn't know for a long time, because her disease doesn't have a name and we didn't have other people to talk to, we didn't have a prognosis. So this wasn't a situation where you can say, like, yes, your kid's going to live to be in their 60s and or, you know, something like that, or they're going to live to be in their 20s or till they're five, like nothing, literally nothing, no information. And so, of course, my priority was spending time with her and taking care of her. But after a few years, we kind of saw that her health became more predictable. she hasn't gotten, like, better or anything. We just know how to manage her condition better. And it's, again, I think predictable is probably the best word for that. After we settled kind of into that space, I felt like I could commit to coming to graduate school. I just kind of knew that, like, if I didn't go to graduate school, it was one of those things that I was going to regret, like, for the rest of my life. And I think it's really hard to, like, step away, like, know I was going to be taking away time from being with my child when, again, we don't know how long we were going to have with her. But at the same time, I was like, it's not great for her either to have a parent that's, like, not miserable, but you know what I mean? Like, a parent that's, like, missing something that just isn't, like, fully themselves. Like, I knew that if I was happier and felt fuller and more fulfilled as a person, that I could be a better parent mm-hmm. for her. And so I decided that to go to graduate school, that I needed to study something that, even if it wasn't her disease specifically, I wanted to study her family of diseases. So I wanted to study leukodystrophies because I felt like if I was going to take that time away from her, I needed to somehow also, like, give back to this community and to this situation that we were in. So that's kind of how I got to where I am now. I don't think I answered. I don't know if I answered your question.
No, you totally did. That was perfect. And I'm really glad that you mentioned this aspect of kind of being stuck between a rock and a hard place of, like, wanting to stay home mm-hmm. with your child and take care of your child, but also feeling the need to basically, not to be cheesy, but, like, follow your dreams mm-hmm. and, like, do something that felt really important to you. And I think that's a struggle that a lot of caretakers can relate to. I think when you are taking care of a family member, a friend, anyone really, with a debilitating disease or disorder, you pretty much put your whole life on pause. Like, that becomes a very full-time job. So I think it's really impressive and inspiring to hear kind of, like, how you worked through that and to hear just, like, your thoughts on the decision to go back to school and get your degree. And I think, yeah, it's obviously a very hard decision, but it's really great to know that you can do both. Like, you can be a really effective caretaker and mother and also be doing this incredible research and being a scientist.
Like what Ali was saying, I also really think that even outside of the context of caretaking, I think it's so important that we talk about the restrictions that a lot of people face in pursuing what they want just because of life circumstances.
Absolutely.
Like, money is a big thing. Mm-hmm. Opportunity is a big thing. And I think it's really important that we talk about it and that academia, science in general, is paying attention to that kind of thing so that we can make it so that more people can be scientists. And hopefully there are less life circumstances that get in the way of people fulfilling their wishes for their career. And that's outside of science as well. That's really for anything. I just want everyone to be happy and have fun in life. That's all I'm asking for.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, I feel like, I feel very privileged to have been able to make that choice, right? Because ultimately, I was like, the time's going to pass anyway, right? Like, 7 years is going to go by whether or not I'm in a PhD program. And so I may as well, like,
get a PhD.
Yeah, get something out of it.
So true.
I think the kind of paucity of there being graduate student parents in general, like you said, is very connected also to, like, the financial aspect that you could get an industry. If you have a bachelor's in, like, biotechnology, you can get an industry job. And after you've been working, you know what I mean? You could probably get paid more than you do as a graduate student. And I think that's probably a big, like, gatekeeper for parents joining programs is just the financial part. It's interesting, though, that there's some NIH fellowships that will give you extra money for daycare. Mm-hmm. You can put that into your budget, like if you're applying for like an F-31. I have seen schools in California do this. I haven't looked anywhere else, but they also will give you extra money in your stipend if you have like a dependent. So if you have a child, they'll like give you a couple thousand extra dollars in your stipend every year. And so I do feel like, even though it's a challenge, it seems like the landscape is starting to change and that it's starting to be noticed that this is probably one of the big reasons why there's fewer parents and then fewer women specifically that are parents that are coming in to these programs. So, yeah, I'm glad to see that it's changing, but it does take time. And it is hard when you look at a program and you see, like, you're looking at the classes or, you know, people who are in the class and you're like, there's, like, no moms in the class. And you're like, why is that? Right? And so for me, I know I was the only mom in my class when I joined. There were, like, I think 6 or 7 other dads, but I was the only mom. And I think there's only been, like, one mom in the class after me and, like, one in the class after. So there's definitely... It's definitely a higher bar for women with children to be able to make this sort of commitment than it is for men with children and then for people that don't have any children. So yeah, I do feel lucky, though. I was very obviously having 7 years between when I graduated and when I actually came to school, I had a lot of time to think about what kind of environment I wanted to work in, what kind of program I wanted to be in. What were my requirements for a PI in a lab? And I want everybody who doesn't have a PhD but wants one to think about this. You are allowed to have boundaries. You're allowed to have requirements when you go into school and you're choosing where you're going to spend the next 6 or 7 years of your life and make a lot of personal sacrifices to be there. So my boundaries and requirements were like, I'm a really hard worker. And but I can't be here like 9 to 5. Like that's never going to work for me. Yeah. And so I needed to be in a lab where like I knew that my PI would kind of develop that trust with me and be like, that's fine. As long as you're getting your work done and you're making progress, like be here when you need to be here. And I knew I would need, you know, a lab environment that that was also going to be supportive of me being a parent and where I wasn't going to be like the odd person out. So I rotated in other labs that had parents in them already, just because I knew that that environment would be understanding of my situation. Those are really important things for me to look for. And I think you can probably find those things at any school. You just have to have very frank, straightforward conversations with any lab you're thinking about joining. Talk to the people that are already in that lab and say, what does the PI say the culture of their lab is versus what do the people who are in the lab?
Yeah, make sure it adds up.
Yeah, do the math. It's definitely possible, but I think you do have to put in a little more work to figure out. You can't just wing it. you have to do a little bit of homework, but you can do it.
So. Definitely second your sentiment about making sure that the lab is a good fit for you and having those really honest conversations about what your priorities are. I think a lot of PIs, especially the ones that we interact with, are really flexible about working hours, and it's really a good feeling when your boss feels like they can trust you to get the work done and they don't need to be having you clock in and out. And I think I can speak for Allie and I when I say that we both chose a PI who would be okay with us doing SciComm like 10 plus hours a week because that's important to us. And we all know that we're going to get our research done also. So in July, you were interviewed by the New York Times about how your family and yourself really rely on Medicaid to provide your daughter the care that she needs. We will, of course, put this article in the show notes. I really highly encourage everyone to check it out. Personally, it was very meaningful to me to read it. I kind of just wanted to start this part of the conversation by asking, how does what you talked about in the New York Times article kind of intersect with your research?
Yeah, so I think, of course, whenever there's big funding changes, right, like let's say to Medicaid, that our economy is a web, right? So when you make a big change in one area, it's going to be reflected and felt and reverberated to all these other areas. And so for me personally, sitting where I do, I am on one hand, I'm seeing government spending get cut for people that rely on Medicaid. And people will say, well, if you're a citizen or if you're disabled or whatever, like it's fine. If you're following the rules, it's fine. But people don't realize how hard it is to get like disability Medicaid in the first place. And that going to all the doctor's appointments and doing everything that you need to prove to say like, yes, I am disabled, how much time that takes and how much money that takes if you don't have it, even actually if you do have insurance coverage, right? It's a lot of time and money to even get to the point where you will meet whatever qualifications you need to meet to be in that program. So it's already a really, like, it's already a high bar to even get on these types of programs. And for the program that my daughter is on, we have to recertify, like, every month. We have to send our caseworker, here's prescription changes, here's diagnostic changes, here's the appointments that we went to. And then,
wow.
Yeah, it's like managing somebody else's care really is like it's a full time job. And so we do that every month. And then every year we actually have to sit down and have like another appointment where we go over like all of the paperwork for the year and recertify that way as well. And then because we do have nurses from agencies that come and help take care of her a few days a week, we have to recertify with those two agencies every 60 days as well. And this is just to keep coverage. This is just to keep what we have going. It's not even to get onto a program or, you know what I mean? Like, this is just to maintain. This is maintenance.
Yeah, that's something that I guess I'm lucky in that I have no idea. I don't even know what the disability application process is or the maintenance, like you were just saying. And I think it's something that a lot of people don't even think about unless you're directly involved. So I think it's really important that I appreciate that you're explaining this. So how long did it take you to get on a disability plan, do you think?
That's a good question. So June is on what's called a Medicaid waiver. So most forms of Medicaid are dependent on your income, right? So you need to be making under a certain amount of money to even qualify for Medicaid to begin with. On these Medicaid waiver programs, though, they're designed for people that do have these complex issues. And where she's a minor, right, she doesn't have her own income. And so the understanding is kind of like, we will just look at your condition and see what is having your condition like? What's the burden of having this condition? And acknowledging that that's separate from your parents' income. Because I think, like, my husband and I would have to make, like, $500,000 a year or something, you know what I mean, to cover what she needs in a year. And that's not to say that Medicaid's paying out that much a year, because they're not. Medicaid reimburses a much lower amount. Like, Medicaid, the efficiency of their spending is much higher than just a regular person paying for a health service. Medicaid's $100 goes a lot further than just a regular person paying in $100. So for us, like I said, we would need to be making like a lot of money to meet all the needs for her condition. So our state has what's called a medically complex children's waiver. And this is a relatively new program. It was a pilot program for a few years, and then it was like legalized and made like a permanent Utah program a few years later. And I'm trying to remember, I think we joined when it was still a pilot program, but the applications only open like every year, even every other year. And then so you apply with a big group of people, and then they kind of rank the medical needs of everybody in a group, and you get a score. And so there are people in Utah that qualify for this program. There are children that qualify for that, meet the requirements for this program, but they can't get on the program because there's not enough funding. And so what happens is the ranks get resorted every year. So you can have a child that's been on this program for 3 years, and because their ranking maybe is lower, they get bumped off by somebody else in a later year, even though, again, they meet the requirements. So there's just not – so Utah has been pretty good about, like, extending funding year over year. They've made, like, more spots available every year. But there are certainly still more children in Utah that qualify for this program that aren't on it just because the funding isn't there. And it's not a federally protected program. So it's not like you can just move to any state and know that this Medicaid program exists in any state. Unfortunately, we don't have a federal, like, nationwide – disabled child Medicaid program. So
that almost made me cry. I almost just started crying.
Yeah. It's really terrifying to think about, honestly. And like, I can't even imagine living through that of every year wondering if
you're going to get bumped off.
Yeah. Like, that's not a sustainable way for anyone to live. It's kind of unbelievable.
Yeah, so it's hard on the one hand to see, like, that money getting cut, or that, not that money directly, but the way states pay for this program is indirect. And so when we take money from other Medicaid programs federally, it makes it so there's less money for these, quote, optional programs that aren't federal. So that's a whole other conversation. But yeah, so I'm seeing that money getting cut. And then on the other hand, we're seeing the NIH, right, have a 40% budget decrease. And so how are we supposed to take care of people who are disabled and have complex chronic issues in this country when we're taking the money and the effort away to find treatments for them and find cures for them, right? Because if we did that, if we found treatments and we found cures, then they wouldn't need so much Medicaid coverage in the first place. They wouldn't need so much insurance coverage in the first place. And so I'm seeing this squeeze happen at both ends of the problem. So, yeah, it's a really uncomfortable – it's an uncomfortable place to sit right now. And I think when it comes to, like, rare disease research funding and Medicaid funding, it's especially difficult for these groups of people to advocate for funding for themselves. Like, think of somebody – I think we all know somebody that's had cancer, right? They get a diagnosis and they're like, hey, I need to raise money for my treatment. Let's do a fun run, like, before I start chemo, right? And they maybe have some kind of fundraising event. Or they go through chemo and they go through radiology and surgeries. And then when they're done and they're in remission, then they're like, I really want to dedicate – I want to do, like, a campaign to raise money for cancer research, which is awesome. That's amazing. And I love that people have it in themselves to do that. For people with complex, chronic, rare diseases – there is no when you're not getting treatment, when you're done getting treatment, then I can, like, go fundraise and do this other stuff. That doesn't happen. You're sick your entire life. Yeah. You're dealing with these symptoms your entire life. And so you're asking people while they're sick and while they're not well, please go to Capitol Hill, show up for the legislative session and talk to your representatives or start a national campaign, right, for disability Medicaid funding. Like, so these groups are already at a disadvantage. And then when you're asking them to really jump through some pretty extreme advocacy hoops while they're sick, while they're experiencing their condition, like, their condition doesn't take a day off, right? But they still have to consistently show up to advocate for themselves. So I think that's another really difficult part of seeing what's going on, is that if people aren't being taken care of as well, how are they supposed to advocate for themselves?
Yeah, and I'll also add to that. I mean, I think the cancer analogy is a really impactful one because everyone knows what cancer is. Like you said, almost everyone knows someone who has been affected by cancer, but these rarer disorders or diseases, like, people don't know what that is. It's more of a burden to explain that to people and why it actually is really impactful and why we need to advocate for money for things like that. So there's that side of it as well. It's just less known to the public. And then on the other hand, like you said, like, these people do not get a day off. They in no means have the time or, like,
energy
or health capacity to advocate, and neither do the people who are close to them taking care of them. I mean, like you just laid out, like, you are a full-time caretaker, you're also a full-time PhD student, and you're also jumping through all of these hoops to maintain, like, this inflow of money to take care of these medical bills. Like, the process you just explained for having to continue to get basically accredited to receive this money is also a full-time job. So, like, you by no means, even if you are able-bodied, have the time to go and advocate for these things. So, yeah, it just seems like a very impossible kind of, like, mountain to climb at this point.
Yeah, and it's I think especially more amazing that there are so many people that do it. Right. Like, it's sad because, yeah, they shouldn't have to. But there are absolutely so many wonderful disability and rare disease advocacy groups out there. So, yeah, people are doing the work, but we need allies. Right. Every community needs allies. So we definitely need people that aren't affected by these diseases or don't have a loved one with one of these diseases to educate themselves. Because, like you said, we don't have the brand recognition that a lot of other diseases have. So, yeah, we need people to jump in and fight the fight with us. So, yeah.
Absolutely. In my previous research lab, I also studied what would be called rare epilepsy mutations.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So I wouldn't consider them to be super rare, I guess. Well, I studied one mutation that's only been identified in one person.
Wow.
So I guess that is ultra rare, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when I talked to people about it, one question that I often got was, why study the rare disease mutations when you could be studying the more common ones that impact, you know, so many more people? And so I was wondering if you ever got that question or ever get that question when you talk to people about your research. It's very evident that ultra rare diseases are very impactful to the people who experience them on a regular basis. But to people who don't experience it, it's, you know, that question seems like a kind of common one. So do you get that question when you talk about your research? And if so, what do you usually say in response?
Yeah, I have definitely seen the argument of, like, why are we spending government money, right, or taxpayer money on, yeah, researching something that affects a handful of people. So I sympathize with that point of view. And yeah, so what I'd like to say then is that, like, I think as scientists, part of our training when we ask a research question is to make sure that even though what we do is very niche, it also can't be too niche, right? Mm-hmm. We ask questions in such a way, we answer questions in such a way that that it will benefit more than just, like, the direct question at hand. So my project, for example, talking about in adrenal leukodystrophy, looking at kind of like how cells handle and digest cholesterol when they have these diseases. Again, there's that black box that I was talking about earlier where we don't understand how you go from genetics to lipidomics, like how do genes equal all the fats that we have. And so even though this project is focused on adrenal leukodystrophy, still understanding how this one protein, like, has a larger role in the lipidome in our cells, like, that's just a black box in cell biology. Like, answering this question will just help us understand some of the basic mysteries of how the cell works. And then specifically, like, with the cholesterol, you probably don't know somebody that has adrenal leukodystrophy, but you might know somebody that has high cholesterol. You might know somebody that has Alzheimer's, and Alzheimer's is a disease where some of the risk factors are mutations in specific cholesterol genes. And so by understanding this cholesterol economy in the brain will actually help us understand other diseases like having high cholesterol and Alzheimer's and Niemann-Pick and these other, like, brain cholesterol diseases. So yeah, I think that this research definitely serves more than just one purpose. And I think ultimately, again, having a project that really gets at, like, how does this cell work in this specific way? What is this mystery that we haven't figured out yet? I think is really incredible. And I think it's cool that rare diseases are typically rare because they're highly lethal, right? That's why you don't see a lot of people with this named disease, is because it tends to be lethal. And so what that means is that a process that is very integral to the cell's function has been interrupted. And so, again, by studying these diseases, we really get at some basic questions of how cells function that people just haven't even thought to look at or answer or ask about before. So they really do highlight opportunities. They bring us opportunities to do research in areas that are overlooked just at the basic cellular level.
I couldn't agree more. And you summarized what I would try to say to people when they ask me that question much better than I could ever. So thanks for that.
I think that is a really great segue into talking about kind of a general misunderstanding of the science that we do and where the money that we receive goes and kind of what it's actually for in terms of our research. And this, yeah, kind of general misunderstanding of scientists as a group of people and what we do, because I think you highlighted something really important there of, yes, maybe the title of your paper will be something really niche getting at a very specific mutation. But if anyone cared to read along to your discussion, you will probably talk about why your results about this specific thing actually apply to so much else and really impacts our day-to-day biology and functioning and opens the door to a lot of other very important questions to be asked and answered. So I'm curious why you think there is, I guess, kind of this disconnect and misunderstanding of the importance of specific projects and specific work, and why it's a bit harder for the public to see this bigger picture that we're talking about.
Yes, I think, like you're saying, I think we all work on stuff that's so niche, right? Mm-hmm. that it is it is something that we have to learn, right, how to communicate the broader importance to people in general. And I think part of that is just the general lack of science communication between scientists and the public. When you have people that aren't engaged in science as, in their education or as their job, right, when do people actually, like, hear about science? They hear weird media releases, like the news says chocolate is good, and then the news says chocolate is bad, and then, cholesterol is good, cholesterol is bad, it's good. so there's a lot of, like their papers will come out, and then you'll have, like, a science-focused journal entity that, like, writes kind of a more lay-friendly type of report on a paper, and then, like, a national news outlet will then read that report and come up with, you know what I mean? So there's always these, like, weird chains of, like, when science actually happens and what is it? It's a weird game of telephone.
I was just going to say it's like telephone. Yeah. And the message gets a little bit changed every single yes. time that there's a new connection. So that mm-hmm. can be a little problematic sometimes.
For sure. Yeah. So that's, like, one problem, right, is this kind of, like, lack of direct communication between science and the public. And I think part of that is also mediated through government communication. So you have a lot of people right now, especially, that just have an inherent distrust in government in general. It doesn't even matter what our government looks like. Just, like, in general, they don't trust the concept of governments, right? Like, that feels like a violation to them. And so when you have the government is coming out and, like, during COVID or whenever, right, they're saying the CDC says the research shows this and now you cannot do XYZ. If you're a farmer, right, the EPA came out and said you can't use this pesticide, you can't use this fertilizer, you can't use XYZ on your crops. Now, again, the government is using science to tell you, you cannot do XYZ. You know, the FDA comes out and says we shouldn't make food this way. Like, you know, meat packing plants can't do this anymore. So, again, that's the government using science to tell you what you can and cannot do. And so for some people, that's 90% of their interaction with science is that a new rule is imposed on them that's based on science. And so science is now kind of being used as a tool to control them, right, when they don't trust the government. So they don't trust the government, and the government is using science to tell them what they can and can't do. Obviously, the government should be using, like, data and science to make decisions. Like, that's good. But that can't be the only interaction that people have with science. And I think there's also some conflation, too, between, like, medicine and science. Medicine depends on science, but science doesn't depend on medicine, right? And so when you go to a doctor and a doctor puts you on a prescription and that prescription is actually bad for you, or they give you a misdiagnosis, or they ignore your symptoms, then you're being like, well, science is now harming me in these ways, or telling me what I can and can't do, or is making my life worse, essentially, is kind of the perception that people come away from. I think that science does deal with there being blowback from how people experience medicine. So, yeah, it's those two things. I think it's people distrusting the government, but yet that's where they hear a lot about science from. And then, again, this kind of, like, relationship with medicine as well. So, yeah, that's my perspective. That's kind of what I've come to learn just interacting with family members. And then also before I started here at the U, I was doing honeybee research, and I was actually a beekeeper for several years. I would like to be a beekeeper again. But so I had a lot of contact with kind of, like, the agricultural community through that experience. And so really just, like, talking to those people and learning from those people and coming from a place of not, I'm going to tell you why science is good, but approaching it as like I want to have empathy for why these people have this perspective. Why do they have this point of view? You're not going to get anywhere without having some kind of empathy for the people that you're trying to understand. And I think as scientists, if we want to show people really what are all the benefits of science, and it's not just science isn't just made to make rules. We actually do a lot of science to try to improve your life, to bring you treatments for diseases and, like, to make your life better. I think we have to want to understand people, and you can't understand people if you don't even try to have empathy for them, if you're judging them. I think a lot of people do think science is cool. Even people that maybe don't necessarily trust science, I think that they still think science stuff is cool. They just don't like science when they think it's coming from an establishment, when it's, like, institutional. I think that's where this disconnect comes in. And that's why we need more people talking to the public directly about science.
One thing that I learned as a summer camp counselor is that when you want children to do the thing that you want them to do, instead of framing it as don't do this, you should frame it as do this.
Do. Mm-hmm.
So, like, instead of saying...
Parenting hack.
Instead of, totally. I bet you completely understand this, but when you're at the pool and if you say no running, then all that kid's going to want to think about is... I should be running. I want to run so bad. But if you say, what do we do at the pool? We walk. We walk. And we're so safe that way. I'm wondering how we could do that as scientists, where we could say, instead of saying you're not allowed to leave your home, it's mm-hmm. the pandemic, stay home. We could be like, let's all stay home and have a board game night with our partner. Something really, you know, maybe that's just enough to fix our problem. That's probably just my wishful thinking, though.
I think if the goal is to change people's behavior, which you can hear us talk more about this on the previous episode with a science communication researcher, Dr. Sarah Yeoh, but we talked with her about how a lot of times scientists go to communicate science without some very concrete end goal. Mm-hmm. Like, I want this to see XYZ behavior from this group of people that I'm communicating based on the things that I am telling them. And so I think that's a really great place to start of like, okay, if the goal is to change some behavior, if we identified that as our behavioral goal and then kind of backtracked to the type of communication we could use in order to get people to want to do that instead of just blanket statement being like, here's the science if you want to read about it. Bottom line, you need to do this. That's so not an effective way to change behavior.
I also feel like what we're doing right now is we are asking the general public to trust us mm-hmm. and ask questions later. But I mm-hmm. think what the solution is, which I know Allie and I talk about all the time, is you need to build the trust first yeah. with the people that you're trying to help with your science. Mm-hmm. And then once you have that trust will come the trust where they hear what we say and they think that we have their best interests at heart, which we always do. And I think that just the way that we go about things right now, like what you're saying with the pandemic, is a little bit backwards, where how are we supposed to expect people to buy into mm-hmm. a message that they don't trust? And yeah. I think we have to start with building the trust first before we ask people to trust us.
Yeah, I don't remember her name, but we had somebody come for our crew speaker series, and she was saying, we don't need more ways to communicate, we just need more scientists communicating, right? And, so I definitely, I think, how are people going to trust us when they've never seen our faces, they don't know who we are, they don't know what our motivations are for doing this research? Like, I think that's another thing, right? You think about pharmaceutical companies making a ton of money, and you know that, scientists came up with those drugs, right? So you're thinking like, oh, it's the scientists like making a bunch of money. And so, yeah, I think that we need to be like, hey, most science is actually done by just like normal people. It's a lot of public servants, right? There's actually a lot of people that work for the federal government that they could invent something and they're not going to make money off of it because they're a public worker. It's a lot of us just in labs just trying to get our PhDs. So yeah, I think more of us need to be, I think we need to take advantage of all the social media and stuff that we have now. And just this, we have so many avenues to have this direct scientist to layperson communication, and we need to take advantage of it. I know for me personally, I would love to start like an Instagram that's just about science communication. But I think back to when I was in middle school and I still really love science and I was a nerd, right? Or people, it was boring and my peers did not want to listen to me talk about diabetes, just because I thought it was interesting. So I think some of that has carried over as an adult. I still feel hesitant to talk mm-hmm. about my research with people that don't ask about it because I just mm-hmm. assume that they're going to think it's boring or that they're going to be turned off by the conversation.
Or even that they will put you into the category that they might have of scientists who are just trying to make money and don't actually care about the general public. That's mm-hmm. a scary thing to think about. You know, if you expose yourself as a scientist, what if they get the wrong idea about you? That's mm-hmm. also not the best feeling.
I do feel like, I don't know if you guys have had the same experience, but I do feel like in general, I feel like a lot of people I talk to now do think that science is cool. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I do have an album on my phone where I have cool pictures of cells or zebrafish or whatever that I can show them. Because I think too, and I make a point to tell people, your tax dollars help fund this research. And I think, how are taxpayers going to care whether or not the government funds research when they don't know what that research is. So I'm like, hey, you paid for this. Like, you paid for us to be able to do this, and here's what's coming out of that. Like, I think, too, like, talking about changing how we communicate with people, be like, you, here's the investment that you made, and here's the return on your investment. And actually, that it was Kristen Kwan that I heard where she's saying she'll have, like, her iPad, and she'll be on a plane, and she will, like, show it to the person in the seat next to her, and she'll be like, you paid for this, like, you know. So I think that's, like, yeah. So I was like, oh, I have to do that from now on. Like,
I love Kristen Kwan with all my heart.
She's the best. Yeah, I think people are just, like, generally excited to see stuff, and they think that it's cool. So, yeah, I think again, yeah, just framing it like, you paid for this and you should be getting something out of it. Here's what you're getting out of it, helps people, I think, understand why that's important.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think it is really cool to, when I do talk to people, I think you're right. Like, everyone is really excited to be like, oh my gosh, you're a neuroscientist? Like, that's so cool. What does that even mean? And, like, they get very excited about it. And I think that really makes me think back to your point of, like, where are people getting most of their information or associations that they make with science? Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, typically the government or doctors. And that goes back to this kind of trust factor that we're talking about, where, like, historically, the government or medical institutions have really, I want to say a bad word,
not had the best
the government and medical institutions have historically really mistreated a lot of marginalized groups and individuals. So it makes sense why people would not trust those entities. But that doesn't mean that they don't think science is cool. Like, it's kind of this dichotomy of like, oh, I don't trust these entities and these institutions, so therefore I don't trust the information that I'm getting from them. Therefore, I don't trust the science or the scientists. But on the other hand, you show them a picture of a glowing fish, which we all work with zebrafish, and our fish glow. It's super cool. And they're like, oh, my gosh, that's amazing. So it really is just like, if we in any way can change the association with science from these big, scary, not trustworthy institutions back to us as individuals who are just excited about this really cool work. And like you're saying, taking these people's money and hopefully turning it into something wonderful for all of humanity. I think that goes a long way.
I also feel like every single person who does science can come up with a cool thing that the general public gets really jazzed about. And I just imagine a world in which every single scientist reaches out to one person a month, like a stranger once a month, and tells them about their research. We could get so many people excited about science. We could show people the actual human beings behind the science, and we could really change the way that the public perceives science and scientific information. That's kind of my utopia, honestly.
That's kind of a great idea. Like, I don't really like I don't think most people enjoy small talk, but maybe if I could repurpose my small talk sometimes to be for like this greater good.
I recently got on SSRIs and I've generally tolerated small talk a lot better since then. So I highly recommend another innovation of science.
And that concludes our episode.
But yeah, that I have had the ability to like meet with patients that have this disease, or families, you know, parents of children with this disease, and form relationships with them. And also a lot of these families are really interested in being involved in research and learning about the research to the point that they offer getting a biopsy so that we can culture their cells and then like screen drugs or learn about the symptoms on a cellular level from their own tissue. So I think that's like a way that obviously not everybody has that opportunity and not every lab has the opportunity to take samples from patients, but that's how invested people are in that kind of research, that they're willing to be like, please, like, to, you know, have some of my skin to use for your research. So I think it's cool because it's kind of an unconventional like way of the public being involved in science.
And I think that is also really great to keep in mind after all of our talk about people not trusting science and not supporting science. Like, it's good to remember, especially as scientists, that there are so many people out there that are so invested in the work we do and are literally, like you're saying, willing to put their own bodies on the line for this work. So it's always easy to get kind of doom and gloom when it comes to people not trusting science, but there are so many people out there who really support us, and that's wonderful.
So maybe we need to be braver, right, about, like you're saying, like being more willing to talk to people about science. And it's okay if they think you're a little weird, or it's okay maybe if they – if somebody's going to group you with an establishment, there's nothing you can do about that. But, yeah, that we should be braver and bolder in wanting to talk to people and really not underselling people, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think in some ways when we are hesitant to talk about science with people, we're undercutting them. We are just making – we're not giving them the benefit of the doubt. We're assuming something negative – honestly, in a roundabout way about them by choosing not to share our science with them because we've assumed that they're going to react a certain way. So I think we need to have more faith in other people and just be braver and bolder about sharing.
Well, thank you so much, Courtney, for taking the time to come on today and share your journey in science. I really enjoyed talking about your experiences, and you're welcome to come back anytime you want.
I would love to, honestly. This was so much fun.
Yeah, it's really fun to hang out in the pod, I'll be honest. If you liked this episode of Planet SciComm, please follow the Planet SciComm podcast on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, consider leaving us a review and sharing the show with your friends. We hope that we can reach as broad of an audience as possible because everyone deserves to be part of science. If you have any questions or comments on the episode, please feel free to email us at utahsciencecommunicators@gmail.com. If you want to learn more about science from the people doing it, feel free to visit our website at utahsciencecommunicators.com. We hope you tune in next time.